This is PCJ Radio International.
I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, asylum seekers to be released in Australia on bridging visas. Hong Kong dock workers accept pay rise and end strike. Ghost nets causing ecological damage across the Pacific region. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. The Australian government has decided to release asylum seeker families into the community on bridging visas, cutting costs, and acknowledging that keeping them in detention centres takes a toll on their mental health. But at the same time, the government has announced that women and children will be again sent to the Curtin Detention Centre in remote Western Australia, something the previous Howard government stopped more than a decade ago, with mental health experts pointing out that goes against both current government policy and professional advice. Australia's immigration minister was moved to say that they'd only be housed there for the shortest possible time while mandatory checks are done. Alexandra Kurt has more.
Asylum seeker families will be issued with bridging visas and released into the community under changes announced by the Immigration Minister, Brendan O'Connor.
Apart from the fact that it's wrong to detain people in those circumstances indefinitely if you don't need to, it's also more expensive.
The Minister won't say what effect the constant influx of asylum seekers is having on the federal budget. The families won't be allowed to work or qualify for Centrelink benefits, instead receiving a smaller allowance, less than the dole. Before being released, they'll have to remain in detention centres for mandatory checks. For the first time, families will be housed at Wickham Point near Darwin and the controversial Curtin Detention Centre in remote Western Australia, which before it was closed in 2002 by the Howard government, saw riots, escapes and self-harm. Labor reopened it in 2010 for single adult male asylum seekers.
Curtin at the moment already has other clients, but this will be a totally cordoned off area, completely separate from other clients that are there currently. And we've got very good providers of care there, but we'll need to include in that teachers and others who can provide the sort of care we would expect to provide to children.
Sending families to what's called an alternative place of detention in Curtin Detention Centre came to light a fortnight ago, sparking an outcry from mental health experts, and the opposition and Greens declared it was no place to house children and families. The minister conceded it was under consideration. Now, he says, hundreds of families could be housed at Curtin if need be, but doesn't want them to remain there for long.
They'll be detained there for only the period whereby they need to be considered for security, identity and health purposes. Currently that's on average 120 days, after which we would expect those families to be accommodated in community detention or provided a bridging visa where they can, of course, be in the community and indeed engage in some cases with families or people they may know that provide support to them.
Very pleasing to hear that we're looking hopefully at very short periods of time in restricted detention facilities.
Professor of Psychiatry Louise Newman is the College of Psychiatrists representative on the government's Immigration Health Advisory Group, which is still in the process of being set up. She remains concerned, however.
We still have major concerns about children going to isolated and very remote processing centres. There are logistic difficulties in providing the health and welfare services and mental health services that are needed in those environments. It would obviously be preferable if any families and children and unaccompanied minors could be housed in metropolitan areas.
And she's critical of another aspect of the announced changes, that families won't be allowed to work, could still be sent to Nauru or Manus Island, and face having to wait years for their refugee claims to be assessed under what's termed the no advantage principle.
This is fundamentally problematic. People do not recover psychologically and emotionally or make positive adaptations in the community and cope with their situation if they have the threat of going somewhere like Nauru or Manus Island.
The opposition's immigration spokesman, Scott Morrison, has dubbed the move Labor's community dumping policy.
I am not confident that putting families on bridging visas with the limited support that is applied currently and with the lack of the sort of guidelines and the lack of any of the sort of framework that you need for a successful program in this area, I'm just not confident those sort of safeguards and protections are in place. The government hasn't done this because they want to put families in the community. They've done this because they've run out of community detention places in the community because there have been too many boats turn up with too many children.
Dock workers in Hong Kong have called off their long-running strike. They've accepted a deal of a 9.8% pay rise. But union officials say the battle for better working conditions will still continue. Richard Erwart has the story.
Strikes in Hong Kong are unusual, and this was the longest in years. Around 450 dockers walked off the job at the end of March, claiming they hadn't had a pay rise for a decade and were expected to work in impossible conditions without meal breaks or access to proper toilet facilities. Their original demand was for a 23% rise, but union leader and Hong Kong legislator Lee Chuk Yan has described the deal that's been done as a face-saving compromise.
We got 9.8% wage increase across the board for all the subcontractors, workers inside the terminal. So it's not just for the strikers, but all workers inside the terminal will get a 9.8%.
But the battle isn't over yet. Mr. Lee says dockers will continue to camp outside the headquarters of billionaire port operator Li Ka-shing until work is found for 100 crane operators who lost their jobs when a stevedoring company went bust during the strike.
We need to reinstate them or to get them re-employed inside the terminal, and this is something that we have negotiate in the future.
And union leader Stanley Ho says there is still the question of working conditions.
This is half successful till this moment because we believe that we have a long fight in the future.
Port managers say they can now focus on restoring full operational capabilities. The strike has led to a backlog of as many as 90,000 containers, according to the Hong Kong Association of Freight Forwarding and Logistics. And some shipping companies have chosen to bypass Hong Kong in favour of nearby Shenzhen in mainland China or other ports in Asia.
Ghost nets, as the name suggests, are virtually invisible, can't be traced, and cause ecological damage by entangling fish and other sea creatures. They also cause damage to fishing boats and other vessels. Evidence from data collected by the organization Ghost Nets Australia indicates that thousands of discarded fishing nets are adrift in the Pacific and the rest of the world's oceans. Joanna McCarthy speaks next to Ricky Gunn, the project manager for Ghost Nets Australia.
It is very remote, Dobbo. It took me 5 aeroplanes to get there from where I live in eastern Australia. And we had a workshop with local fishermen, and we also visited a industrial trawl complex in another village on the island.
So how do you educate these fishermen about these ghost nets, which after all are invisible and really impossible to track? What's the message you have for them?
Well, we're not just in the process of educating. We're actually fact-finding. We're trying to find out the distribution of ghost nets throughout the Arafura Sea, as well as try and look at what gear they use and compare that to the nets and the rubbish that we find on Australian shores. So there's a little bit more to it than just education. But to answer that question, the first thing is to just bring to their understanding that when a net is lost or disposed of at sea, it doesn't just disappear. That's the hardest part.
And what can you tell us about, expand on the sort of impact these nets have on oceans and ocean life?
Impacts, of course, are on species of concern. In Australia, we're most concerned about the impact on marine turtles, as not just northern Australia, but the whole Indonesian archipelago are very important turtle nesting and breeding grounds, as well as dugong and other sort of pelagic species. But there's also a more insidious threat that is created by not just ghost nets, but plastic in general. And that is that the plastic takes more than 450 years to break down. And in that time, it just breaks into smaller and smaller and smaller particles until we're getting down to the nanoparticle level, which for some strange reason absorb toxins that are in the water, various poisons from other plastics, and these particles get eaten by small biota or small animals, which get eaten by bigger animals. So eventually we're actually poisoning our food chain through all this plastic that's in the water. So it's not just ghost nets, it's any plastic.
And what's the response you're having from fishermen when you tell them about the impact that their nets are having on the ocean? Are they receptive to your message?
Oh, yes, they're very receptive. They're very it's pretty mind-blowing for them because they weren't aware that for a start that things just don't just disappear in the ocean as they thought. That they go somewhere or that they continue to live in some form. So that's a big sort of step in the first place. But then once we get past that, they're very open to working through this issue and to trying to come up with solutions, which is what we're aiming at. But the biggest part is that we've got to also remember we've got to make sure that we sort of let them know that we're not actually trying to stop them fishing or trying to create problems for them. We're just trying to sort of get them to change behaviour a little bit.
Now, this is obviously a regional problem. Is there anything being done on the regional level to try and combat it?
Well, the work we've just done in Dobbo. This was the third workshop we've had in the Arafura Sea. The other two were in Merauke in the Papua province of Indonesia and Ambon in Maluku province of Indonesia. These were initial workshops where we're just sort of raising that whole profile of ghost nets as an issue and getting to some reasons behind why nets might be lost. What we do know, what we have found from these workshops is not very many nets are actually discarded because they're so valuable to the fishermen. So when nets are, mainly they're lost at sea and they're too hard for them to retrieve. So from now on, we're going to, we'll be having another workshop in Ambon in July where we're going to bring some of these fishermen back to the table and we're going to start exploring that gear loss in a lot more detail and see if we can come up with an action plan.
A consumer group in Australia has said companies that label their cosmetics as animal testing free are lying to the public. It was discovered that some of the world's leading brands that distribute their product in China must conduct animal testing to enter the market. Amy Bainbridge has the story.
Many Australian product-savvy consumers are keen on cosmetics that are not tested on animals.
I use a couple of big brands and one has actually just started testing on animals, so it's going the other way around. So I haven't been using it anymore.
I have brands that I'm very loyal to and I know that they don't test on animals.
But Choice says claims of being cruelty-free are not always as they seem. It says companies that export to China can't make such claims because all products exported there must be tested on animals to gain market access.
The big brands that a lot of women are using and a lot of women think are actually cruelty-free or not tested on animals when in fact that's not strictly accurate.
Choice is pointing the finger at major brands including L'Oreal, L'Occitane and Bobbi Brown. Its report, due out tomorrow, highlights this statement on the website of L'Occitane.
We respect the right of each country to set their own laws and regulations.
And this from Bobby Brown.
We do not conduct animal testing, except when required by law.
The ABC contacted five of the companies. L'Oreal says,
our commitment to advancing the cause of alternative methods to testing remains unchanged.
China's cosmetics market has fast become one of the biggest in the world, and that means companies are faced with the decision of whether to capitalise on that boom or stay strictly animal cruelty-free.
Until China changes its stance on animal testing, we are prepared to not enter that market.
People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals says China is developing a non-animal test for cosmetics, but companies should avoid the market until the new test is being used. A spokesman for the Australian Cosmetics Industry Body Accord says the Chinese market is a complex issue and requirements for product approval can be confusing. Choice is lodging a complaint with the ACCC, claiming the brands are misleading consumers.
Under Australian consumer law, manufacturers and companies have a responsibility and have a legal responsibility, in fact, to give consumers the right information when they seek it out. So we don't think that it's fair to say that it's a consumer's responsibility to find out whether a company is actually giving them misleading and deceptive information.
The ACCC says it will assess the information supplied by Choice.
There are current negotiations underway to open the Rio Tinto mine in Borgane, Papua New Guinea, that closed 20 years ago because of a bloody civil war. Jeremy Godup caught up with some of the students from the University of Papua New Guinea to find out how they feel about the future of the mine reopening.
The Bougainville crisis left deep scars on those involved. It's the Pacific's only major war since independence, and it reduced what had been PNG's most developed province into a living nightmare. More than 10,000 people died. The war divided the community and the nation and brought down the government of Prime Minister Sir Julius Chan after he hired mercenaries to put down the rebellion. Bougainville became a lesson in how not to manage a world-scale mining project. Novada, Vice President of the University of Papua New Guinea Student Representative Council, was a small boy when these events took place.
For us as young people, we're all barely out of our teens, and for us, the Bougainville crisis seems a very distant idea.
Distant, but not forgotten.
We know about it through songs and through essays that we've read. We really were not impacted by the crisis when it happened. Not in the way our parents were, because they lived through the crisis. We have to remind ourselves, as people who will one day dictate what happens to this country, economically, socially, in government or in private sector, that the Bougainville crisis represents something that needs to be avoided at all costs.
At the time it closed, the Bougainville copper mine was the PNG government's biggest single source of revenue. Chemistry student Sarah Griffin is aware of the complexity of the decision to reopen the mine and believes it should lie with Bougainvillians.
As an environmental scientist, from that point of view, it would be destructive. But given the grounds that they do have to maintain themselves, I wouldn't have a say in that. It would be a lot more personal.
The Panguna copper mine is seen by many Bougainvillians as the economic lifeline that will give them the opportunity to win independence. Novada can see the challenges that lie ahead.
If PNG is serious about giving the independence, then we have to make sure that Bougainville, when it does get its independence, can sustain the independence. Because a failed state will mean a bad thing for everyone. In the same time, we cannot hold them against their will. If the people of Bougainville feel that they have to be their own state, then I think Papua New Guinea must be obliged to let them go about their own political self-determination. But premature allowance of this has its own risks as well. A failed state, the onus, the responsibility of going back and fixing any failed state, if there is a failed state, and God forbid such an event should happen, we'll go back to PNG, and that is our concern, my concern.
Political science student Claire Arcee agrees Bougainville is a sensitive subject with implications for the whole nation.
We have a history together as one country. So whether we experience the Bougainville crisis or not, they are a part of us. And I believe that that is important in itself.
Would it worry you if Bougainville did vote for independence?
I think the worry would be that it would create an avenue for other provinces to want to get their succession and independence as well.
As a result of the Bougainville Peace Agreement, the PNG government is already handing over many powers to the autonomous government of Bougainville. President John Momus is keen to give more say to landowners and has announced his new mining legislation will allow them to veto mineral exploration on their land. Law student Novada supports devolution but worries about the capacity of the Bougainville government to implement its plans.
You can have policies that are outlined so gracefully and legislation, you know, so detailed. How do you implement them? How do you get the human managers, the human coordinators on the ground to organize an island of different, where each village has its own language, each village has its own customary land tenure systems, it has its own political hierarchical systems. How do you get all of them to agree on a mode where this option can be used? Often, as is the case in PNG, we have the perfect example being the Environment Act, a legislation that would seem to support national interests, seem to support landowner interests, but in reality, when it's enforced, landowners often have very little say in what happens. That is not just a problem for political scientists and lawyers, really. It's a problem for people who study culture, people who study societies.
In the months and years ahead, the debate on Bougainville's future will enter a new phase. If these students at UPNG are anything to go by, it's clear Papua New Guinea's young generation is ready to make a contribution.
Well, that there was a little sample of some Cambodian pop music from the 1960s and 1970s. In the 60s and 70s, rock music was huge in Cambodia. Khmer musicians had been influenced by Western music brought over by American GIs to the region during the Vietnam War. The music scene flourished until musicians, as well as many other artists, were systematically targeted by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. Jonathan Green speaks next to Julian Paulson, a guitarist from the Cambodian Space Project.
Look, like all good things, it was a complete accident. I was actually supposed to be off to East Timor to do a music project, and conflict had flared up there, so no one was starting arts projects. And I went back to the map and had a second look and chose Phnom Penh.
And musically, what did you find?
At first I found very little, and then I came across a blind Chapai player called Master Kung Nai, a survivor of the Khmer Rouge.
Chapai is
the Cambodian long-neck lute. So Kung Nai is called the Ray Charles of Phnom Penh because he looks like Ray Charles. I mean, it's uncanny, but he's more like Leadbelly. It sounds really, really primal and bluesy, so I met him down at a tin house where he was then living, and that got me going, returning any chance I could to Cambodia and seeking out more, and eventually I found Srey Chanti and
your singer
joined a band of the Cambodian Space Project with our singer, our Khmer Diva.
For that she is. Extraordinary voice.
I mean, she has had an extraordinary journey with that voice. She was born the daughter of a Cambodian tank driver in Praving Province, the most bombed province on the planet, and came out of that apocalyptic childhood and is at the forefront of this cultural revival that's happening.
Let's go to that revival idea and this mixture of East and West during the time of the Vietnam War and the conflict in Cambodia and the music that came with it. What came from that cross-fertilization?
Well, in Cambodia particularly, an extraordinary result. And, I mean, it was already sort of underway with the independence movements that had happened after the Second World War. French colonialism still had a cultural influence. And the British invasion, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, Jimi Hendrix, and then, of course, sounds from GI radio.
Yes.
And the war that was looming on Cambodia's doorstep, which, of course, tragically resulted into all-out civil war and the Khmer Rouge taking control in 1975 and targeting culture itself. You know, in Cambodia today, you cannot find any of the old records. There were thousands of singles of this psychedelic garage kind of rock and roll produced. But if you try to find any of the original material, it's just not there.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end today with a song from the Cambodian psychedelic rock scene from the late 1960s. The singer's name is Ross Serasoyata. The song is called Kut Song Dai Ang. So until next time, we'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye.